I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man, I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man, I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man, I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa.
Hello, hello, Vashon Island. My name is Megan Hastings, and this is the Cats and Jammer Follies, a travel story show. And today we have a few of my darling friends on. First, we have Chris Basha. He is a local chef, actor, director, teacher, and political activist. After him, we have the lovely Tarina O'Rourke, also a fellow thespian and writer and a producer of plays on the island with her theater company, Take a Stand Productions. Chris Basha is going to be sharing a story of his childhood growing up in Spain in the mid-late 70s. And later, we're going to have a story from Tarina, who's going to tell a story about going to Algeria and her journey getting to Algeria and the time there, also in the mid to late 70s. As it turns out, they could have possibly been in Spain at the same time in like 1979. How crazy is that? And then here they are on Vashon Island. All right, so Chris Basha, you're up first, and we are going to have you read this beautiful story. Take it away.
Muchas gracias, Megan.
De nada.
It's wonderful to be here.
Thank you so much for being here.
So when I think of my boyhood in Spain, I don't just think about what you normally think I should be thinking about. Well, do I think about the famed Mercat de la Boquería in Barcelona, the almost 200-year-old public market with its fishmongers and wine cellars, its tapas bars, fruit stands? Of course. In fact, I remember holding my nanny Josefina's hand on a cold, early Tuesday winter morning. And I would always spot the hanging rabbits at the butcher shop and smell the wafting, glorious smells of churros frying in their vats of oil. And I would yearn to dip the crunchy goodness in my own little pot of hot, thick, delicious chocolate. Do I think of playing seaside in the hot summer sun, running relays with my friends and playing spot the British tourists with my brothers and then poking fun at their hoity-toity cute accents? Yes, I do. Do I remember going on field trips with my schoolmates, the endless list of museums and castles and historic battlefields? Of course I do. In fact, I still own a keychain from the tourist shop at the Alhambra, in fact. Oh, and of course, my love of football, or soccer, is deep-seated in my brain. In fact, what boy in Spain didn't have his favorite teams? I was always an Atletico Madrid fan, and I rooted for Spain year after year during the World Cups. But lucky for us, football was always on TV. Always. So I guess I do remember everything that any other kid would remember about Spain after all. But see, I had the good fortune of spending a great portion of my childhood growing up all over Spain. My American stepdad, he worked in shipping, and we were whisked around year after year to different seaports around the country. From Barcelona, La Cuna del Mediterráneo, or the cradle of the Mediterranean, as it was often called, to Algeciras in the south, which, by the way, provided me with endless weekend access to Morocco with my teenage buddies on a mere hour-long hydrofoil trip across the Straits of Gibraltar, to Estepona, which was a small town outside of Marbella, where there were more American, German, and British expats than there were Spaniards themselves. But lucky me, those expats, they had built a movie theater in Puerto Banús, which was basically a yacht club on steroids. And I got to sit for hours upon hours watching all the amazing American imported movies of the 1970s. And they were not dubbed. They were in actual English. More than anything, though, I remember waiting all year long for the most amazing TV competition in history. To this day, still, the Eurovision was our version of American Idol, but way better, way tackier, and way wackier. The Europe-wide singing competition was always the highlight of our year, and Spain's contenders were always in the running. One year, we actually entered the contest, which what was to become a very famous worldwide song, Eres Tú. Eres tú como el agua de mi fuente. Yeah, I know all the lyrics to that song. See, I was a New York Cuban American kid growing up in the 1970s in Spain, and it was a very odd time in Spain. See, I didn't know it at the time, but as I look back, I realized how very, very oppressive living in a very, very fascist country was at the tail end of one of the most successful dictators in world history, Francisco Franco. Well, sure, we only had one government-run TV channel on TV. Bullfights all day on Sunday, anyone? And sure, divorcees like my mother and gay boys like me were considered undesirables. So we kept a secret, and no one knew our secrets. See, it was illegal. Sure, the beautiful Barcelona tree-lined boulevards and plazas dotted with markets and boutiques and panaderias were also named after some of Franco's favorite despots. Avenida José Antonio, Primo de Rivera, Plaza Calvo Sotelo, and then, of course, there was Avenida Generalísimo Franco. Yes, there was an avenue named after him. And I also remember being forced by law to have my first communion. My Cuban mother had simply forgotten to tell us that we were supposed to be religious in Spain. And I went, of course, kicking and screaming, but catechism was my second least favorite subject in school, next to gym class. Except for that one year I spent at a British expat school in Marbella, where gym class was held on the beach, and we could swim in the Mediterranean. We could also smoke cheap black market Marlboro cigarettes and drink tea in short glasses as we munched on pan con chocolate. So why am I telling you this story today? Because I also remember the Guardia Civil, the not-so-civil guard that would patrol and follow us around at all times. The Guardia Civil was founded as a national police force in 1844 during the reign of Reina, or Queen, Isabella la Segunda, the second, by the second Duke of Ahumada and the fifth Marquess of Amarillas, who was an 11th generation descendant of an Aztec emperor. Yes, we were forced to memorize all those little facts in my private little fancy school in southern Spain. And we didn't mess with La Guardia, ever. But then why would we? With their daunting green police military outfits standing guard on highways or outside of stores or at subway entrances and bus stops, their threatening presence was always in our psyche. And as a reminder that they meant business, they'd stand guard, proudly wielding their weaponry. They'd securely hold their hands on their rifles, admiring their sharp, glistening, menacing bayonets attached. Oh, and yes, they were racist too. Well, with the proximity to Morocco and Northern Africa, to them, it was a given that any dark-skinned resident of Spain must be up to no good. See, Spain had still not gotten over the fact that the Moors had invaded them centuries earlier. Now, here's why I'm telling you this story today. I remember my good friend, Jaime Espinosa. I think we were in eighth grade. And with a Moroccan mom and a Catalan dad, he was a beautiful brown kid. And he was my only best friend that year. That one night, we swiped my stepdad's moped from the garage. See, I wasn't allowed to ride it without him. And we both hopped on as I maneuvered our way on country roads, zigzagging throughout the village of Estepona, or getting stuck in the sand at the beach, and then pretending that we were movie stars, like Jack Nicholson and early and Easy Rider. And then when it was his turn, when it was Jaime's turn to drive, I remember distinctly one night that he suddenly sideswiped on a side road heading into town, and we skinned our knees and we bent the frame of the front wheel of my dad's moped. Oh, duh. I yelled, ¿Qué hiciste, hombre? ¿Qué eres tonto? What did you do? Were you stupid? Well, it was because he had spotted La Guardia in the distance and he didn't want to face them. He was petrified. He couldn't get us caught. After all, it wasn't our bike. It was past curfew and we had Marlboros in our pockets. After all, we were teenagers. So we quickly turned back, ending our nighttime joyride abruptly. Oh God, I knew I was going to get into trouble. And sure, I did get into trouble. And I was never allowed back on that bike again. But for Jaime, that night was a regular occurrence to him. I would never know. See, I was light-skinned, and I fit in nicely to a Spanish lifestyle, even though I was a Cuban kid. But Jaime, he didn't. You know why. The memory of Jaime and how his skin color almost could have gotten him into worse trouble than me still daunts me to this day. Because he was brown. Jaime's dad worked for El Corte Inglés, which was kind of like a Spanish Sears-style department store. And he soon moved away to Madrid. And I never heard from him ever again. Then I often think about him, especially with what we're facing in this country now. And I just want to reach out and ask him if he remembers me, to tell him that I miss him and that I see him and I will always fight for him. Always.
Una mañana de verano, como una sonrisa eres tú, así, así, eres tú. Toda mi esperanza eres tú, como lluvia fresca.
That was such a beautiful story and so beautifully told from the heart. Thank you very much. I really appreciate you telling that. It certainly paints both the beauty and the ugliness of Spain at that time. And, mm-hmm. you know, having, I've only been to Spain once. I was like, I think I was 16 years old, and I spent a month in Madrid. So I don't know it very well, but, you know, it's very easy to romanticize a place like Spain. We sure. all, so not we all, but so many Americans, primarily Caucasian Americans, I think, romanticize about going to Europe and reclaiming some history of our own that we don't necessarily have here or can't find or searching for. And so my question to you is, what prompted you to tell this particular story today with us? It seems very poignant.
Sure. You know, I think about Spain every day.
Yeah.
And I think about when I tell people I grew up in Spain, they go, "Oh, that must have been wonderful to grow up in Spain." And yeah, it was wonderful to grow up in Spain, but it was also hard. You know, Francisco Franco was no joke.
Yeah, he was no joke. He was serious.
No joke. Yeah. Luckily, he died while I lived in Spain. Unluckily.
Can you tell us a little bit about the feeling of that? When I mean, do you remember it?
Oh,
you must.
Course.
It must have been the biggest thing that happened when you were there.
Well, see, at the time, I was going to an American school, international school, and I remember it happened around Thanksgiving,
mm-hmm.
and I remember thinking, "Yeah, we get days off," and we had like a whole week off of school for
like
for
any good teenager
we're,
would.
we're supposed the entire country was supposed to be in mourning, and I remember flying with my mother to Madrid. To visit my friend Mary Liz, and we went to go and see Rollerball. I don't know if you remember that movie Rollerball, but we went to the movie.
Is that
to
like
see
a Xanadu?
It was like it was an intense racing movie, very violent.
Oh, okay.
So that's what I remember about Franco dying. But there was no celebrations until many years later. And here's the thing: Spain now is one of the most progressive cities.
Right.
I mean, countries in the world.
Yeah.
First to have gay marriage, et cetera, et cetera. So the relevance. Is with when I think about Francisco Franco,
mm-hmm.
I actually think about where our country may be headed with our president.
Like it would be very easy at this point to sort of view, you know, our current president as not unlike a Franco mm-hmm. or, you know, Mussolini or,
right.
or Hitler. I mean, he's been hearkened to many of these,
sure.
Prior dictators that we've had in the world. And as it comes to the feeling or the tone that he sets in this country, racism, mm-hmm. bigotry, oppression. The list goes on and on, you know. And so for this story, in your own words, like, because it is relevant for mm-hmm. today, as it was in, you know, the middle 1970s.
Well, yeah. You know, when I was a teenager, I really couldn't say anything about it. We weren't allowed
right.
to protest. And now I am allowed. As an American, I am allowed to yell out loud as I want.
And you're really doing it.
Yeah.
And I'm really proud of you for organizing
thanks.
All the things that have been going on. It, on Vashon in
yeah, the
last month.
Yeah,
the
entire
month.
Island is stepping up. Thank
yeah.
you. The, you know, I'm really proud of what we're doing here to combat police brutality and racism. And I am thinking about my childhood in Spain
yeah.
when I do this, you know, and I'm thinking about Jaime, who I talk
yeah.
about in the story. And I don't want another kid in this country to grow up in the same fascist way that I had to grow up.
Absolutely.
And so that's where I tell the story. But, you know, I do. I appreciate you saying that. Yeah. I mean, Spain is a glorious place and I can
sure.
still.
of course it is, especially now.
I can still smell the Mercado and see the Mercado, even though it's been years since I've been there.
Chris and I, just for probably nobody really knows this, or well, some people do, but Chris and I work together for about a year.
Yeah,
we cook a lot together, which is one of our favorite things to do, uh-huh. which is very special to me. And we would talk so much about different recipes from
oh, yeah?
Spain. And one of my favorite recipes, a Spanish recipe, comes from another friend of mine on the island. And I think I brought that one to you. It was like a chickpea recipe
oh, yeah.
with red peppers. I mean, very
yeah.
simple, but just beautiful, simple flavors that always taste the best because they're sun-kissed by the Spanish.
Oh, yeah.
By the Spanish sun and all the olives and the olive oil and all the things that we love. And we have so Chris brings many things to the table.
And we have so many things left to cook. So
yeah, we do.
And many stories to
we
tell.
Do.
Thanks for having me, Meg.
Chris, thank you so much. It was a beautiful story, and I really appreciate you coming on.
Anytime.
Thank you. And right now we're going to go over to the lovely Tarina O'Rourke. And she is going to read us a story that she wrote about her time in the late 1970s traveling through Europe and down to Algeria.
Yeah.
Take it away.
Thank you for having me, Megan.
My pleasure.
It's great to be here.
Thank you.
It's interesting. I do believe Chris and I were in Spain at the same time. I was a bit older than him, but
Kismet.
I won't admit how much older. This story is called The Trendy Times of Top Deck Travel. We were just kids, the Brit and I, living on the dirty side of London with barely a penny to our name. One pub crawl night in February, we came upon a group of Aussies. They told us about their new camping, not glamping, travel company. They were leaving for a tour of Europe to North Africa on a bus in a month. Did we want to come along? Yippee-yay, yes, I replied. A month later, after saving every penny and nicking food now and then from the packy shop down the road to survive, we climbed on Top Deck Travel's bus filled with young travelers from all over the world. I was the only American, but everyone spoke English and smoked pot, so I was in my element. The first leg of the journey took us through the magical city of Paris, and then over the Pyrenees Mountains to Andorra, where we encountered an April blizzard. After camping already for 5 days, I was thrilled to learn we would be staying in a hotel with hot showers, American privilege and all that. Kev and I grew closer as our new love affair of 3 months blossomed. New friends, new sights, flavors, and fun filled our days. Spain was next. Outside Barcelona, we went to the champagne caves and drank the bubbly out of strangely shaped carafes in the sun. We laughed and watched the locals sing and dance as we stuffed our faces with tangy cheeses and salty olives. In Madrid, when we stepped out of the Prado, we found ourselves in the middle of a riot. La Guardia on horseback were racing through the streets, showering the young Basque protesters with tear gas. Our hearts were in our throats. Kev and I were able to escape the melee by the skin of our teeth, and now we were in the real thick of life, I thought. Scared as I was, my Hun jeans hummed with the thrill of the chase. Lisbon was gorgeous, though our food money was stolen, so we had to eat canned meat. Disgusting. But I was getting tougher by the day. Sevilla was pure magic, and our ancient bus began to break down there, so we spent hours roaming the gorgeous cathedrals and palaces for a few extra days. Finally, we boarded a filthy ferry to Sutra and soon landed on another continent. Morocco was pure heaven. After floating through Fez in a daze of Arabian Nights, we continued to Marrakesh, a land of the Kasbahs, snake charmers, and camels. Ceaseless streams of black-cladded women passed with mesh slits for their eyes. Wandering urchins begging for money and donkeys were piled high with firewood. We went to a night of belly dancing in a gold-gilded marble palace and bargained for goodies in the Medina with the Medina merchants. I was entranced and completely in love with a culture so opposite my own. We wove our way through the stunning and austere Atlas Mountains to the Mesqui Oasis, where we dined on camel meat and dates. We swam and we washed our clothes in the shade of palm trees and the cool waters of Tadra Gorge, where we sang and acted out Shakespeare in the moonlight in a crumbling Roman amphitheater. Eventually, after camping in a dust storm from hell, we arrived at the Moroccan-Algerian border. That is where the real trouble began. As the only American on the bus, I'd been instructed to get a visa for Algeria. In 1979, Americans were truly despised there. When we reached the gates in the middle of the endless desert called the Sahara, we were greeted by men with machine guns. They searched our luggage, our purses, our bodies, and then called me into their concrete hut, buzzing with countless flies, where they began to interrogate me in French. Well, I had no clue what they were saying. One of my co-patriots could speak French, so she interpreted due to all of our bus breakdowns, we were late by a week arriving there, and my visa was no longer valid. Kev and I were left there with our stupid luggage in 110-degree heat as our bus drove away. We'd have to find our way back to the next Moroccan town with an Algerian embassy, obtain another visa, and meet our bus in Algiers in a week or so. Well, that was the plan. And back in those olden days, there were no cell phones, so we were to look for a posted note in the main post office of Algiers. We had $100 to our name. We walked for what felt like miles and were eventually picked up by some German hippies in a Volkswagen bus. Next, we found a bus to Ouja, surrounded by chickens in cages and goats and pigs and Berbers. We traveled northeast. We slept in a concrete room and listened to the countless calls to prayer in a town void of any modern conveniences. Finally, we were able to get my visa, and we took a bus back to the border. When we arrived, we learned it was highly illegal to take Moroccan dirham or American dollars across. But how are we going to pay for the bus to Algiers on the other side, I asked. I received shrugs, and one Kiwi man in rags whispered, "It's called smuggling." I had to think fast. They were taking women to the back rooms for strip searches. I could hear their cries. Now exotic had suddenly lost its luster. We were terrified. I pulled us out of line. "Listen, Kev, I'm going to cut a slit in our sleeping bag and sew the money that we have left inside. Then when it's to our turn to go through, I'm going to create a distraction." He nodded. By that time, he'd learned I was sort of a wild American girl with one crazy creative mind. When we got to the searching area, I cried out and began to throw everything out of my suitcase onto their table. "I've lost my camera! I've lost my camera!" The guards stopped what they were doing and closed into a tight huddle to discuss what to do with this crazy American blonde throwing her clothes all over their filthy floor. Soon the boss with the biggest gun came back and thrust the suitcase angrily at me. His indecipherable language told me unequivocally to pick up my stuff and get out of there. We were free, sort of. Night had fallen when the bus arrived in Algiers. We were hungry, hot, exhausted, and had found ourselves with a case of the runs. It was the camel meat, we decided. We immediately began to look for a hotel, but one by one, we discovered they were full of families who lived their entire lives there. A housing shortage didn't describe it. We met a young Algerian in the blackness of a narrow street who offered to let us sleep in his room. We agreed it was midnight. I was traumatized by all the leering gazes I was receiving from the robed strangers as we were wandering. I wanted to be inside somewhere soon. The man offered us mint tea and hashish. His room was small, and I could see a rat that ran along one wall and under his bed. We laid down on the floor to sleep, and sometime later I needed to use the hole in the toilet down the hall. As our new friend guided me by candlelight to the lovely facilities, he began to grope me, pulling at my clothing in preparation for a little fun. I should mention, Algerian men are rather short, so I was not that intimidated by this annoying shrimp, and I kicked him hard where it hurts and ran out of the room. And I nudged Kevin, and I began wrapping up my bag. We were on the streets by the first morning call to prayer. Algiers was once a beautiful French outpost, and by daylight, we were able to find a hotel, which took my emergency American Express card. We ate oranges for a week instead of dining on the card and holed up. We were broke, beleaguered by mosquito bites, severe sunburns, and bad guts. Eventually, and quite unexpectedly, we found our travel mates on the main boulevard of Algiers a week later. They'd forgotten all about us, but we hadn't forgot about them. Algeria was the last place on earth I wanted to find myself stranded. We climbed aboard the top deck bus, headed into the Sahara towards Morocco and Europe, and the rest is history. Thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing that story, Tarina.
Yes.
That it brings up a lot of different topics for travel, in particular being a female and traveling, because often that can be, you can really stretch yourself. Let's just say that. Yeah. I have to ask you, in your story, were you scared? Because you're always so like badass and never intimidated by anything. But I mean, you must have had some real fear being so out of your comfort zone, especially, at the end when this man is approaching you in such a, machismo way.
Yes, of course I was scared, and especially that night. I can think back on it and sort of get the shivers, but I had Kevin with me, and, I was a young American woman in love, and he was going to take care of me regardless. I'm pretty sure if he told the story, however, he'd say she was getting in people's faces, and I didn't know what to do. I think he'd tell it very differently.
But I can imagine. you told me earlier that you're starting your own travel company.
Yeah, Kevin and I have started a company.
You want to,
I'll just tell you quickly. It's called Creative Consultants. We're going to probably change the name. It's not too catchy, but we are helping people to retire abroad, Americans who are maybe tired of our political climate or just want to be somewhere fun. And we are starting in Spain. We've just bought our own piso, our own apartment in Granada.
In Granada. That's amazing. And, congratulations.
Oh,
that's
it's
beautiful.
So exciting. It's wonderful. And we'll host friends and, friends from Vashon who say, hey, I might want to retire.
I'm so there.
I am
I
too.
We're all coming for a visit. You better get a bunch of beds ready.
So
line them up.
And it's a really beautiful, Chris, and what you're saying about Spain, it's just a remarkable place. Remarkable. It's magical. It touches your heart. People are so kind.
Yeah, it really does.
And
it's a beautiful country.
It's very, very modern, very progressive. Whatever happened with Franco has long gone into the past from my experience.
It's a whole generation.
I'll bring my keychain from the Alhambra.
Yeah, you do that.
And let me ask you, so you have a knowledge of a bunch of all female travel companies that you had wanted to talk about.
Yeah, you go online and you can find, I pop up and I find 10, and a lot of them are based on adventure travel, hiking, kayaking, yoga retreats.
Yeah.
There's one that I've looked at quite a bit.
Have you ever taken one of these tours?
I have not, because I've always had family members to travel with. So I've been fortunate that way. But these, from what I can read about them, women really feel like they're taken care of and they're safe and they're given what they need, whether it's equipment because they're going to be riding a bicycle through the Netherlands or it's, early passes to get into the Alhambra so that they can see it before the tourists come off the cruise ships.
Yeah.
So, these are the Wild Women expeditions are probably the best for Europe. Because they don't focus so much on the adventure. They focus more on the actual sites.
What about other places like Asia or Africa, is this primarily Europe?
No, there's a lot of them. There's one called FP Escapes, which is one that goes into Asia. Of course, people can do cruises. But really, all a woman would have to do if she was going to travel alone is punch in female travel companies.
Or punch someone.
Or punch. I punch someone.
I know I've been pretty darn close. Yeah, I've been in some pretty sketchy situations myself, having traveled a lot to some pretty weird areas. I'm not afraid to go into weird, crazy places, but you definitely have to have your guard up. That is a fact, And I mean, it's good when you can sit down and, at a cafe and meet people like the one-on-one. But, when you're in a place where you do feel out of your comfort zone, it is good to just be aware.
Yeah.
I don't mean have your guard up completely all the time. I just mean just be aware of your surroundings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And be prepared. I mean, people need to be prepared with whatever it is, some language, learn, the customs and the cultural ways so that they're not offending people too, because
Absolutely.
Every country's different.
That is key. I've got one last question for you. So you are a writer and you write crime novels. Do any of your stories have, are they focused on your travels? Are they focused in Spain, or what is your...
I have one story that's a mystery that takes place in Europe, actually. It's called The DeGracia Prophecy. And then the rest of my novels actually take place in the United States at this point.
Yeah.
I have a series, so we'll see. Maybe a series will go somewhere.
You lived in London, too. Your husband is English-Irish.
Mm-hmm.
Nice. All right. Well, thank you so much and congratulations on your books. Chris Basha, thank you. Tarina, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
It's great to have you guys on. And again, this is the Cats and Jammer Follies, and I'm Megan Hastings, and thank you for joining us.
I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Pittsburgh, Parkersburg, Gravelburg, Colorado, Ellensburg, Rexburg, Vicksburg, Eldorado, Larimore, Atmore, Havistaw, Chattanooga, Chattanooga, Nebraska, Alaska, Opelika, Baraboo.